Chris Jericho, you can go straight to hell and burn in hell because that's where you belong. And I'll help get you there by cutting your tongue in half. And I think that would put an end to your music career. I would be more than happy, Jericho, to take a pair of pliers and cut your tongue in half and watch you bleed to death on your own blood. You may have the face of a choir boy, but you've got the heart of a devil. And your heart is evil. And one day you'll be in hell burning, and somebody will walk across and see your skull on the floor of hell, because that's exactly where you belong, Chris Jericho. Chris Jericho, every time you move your teeth, you sound like an idiot. I despise you that much. One of these days, you'll be found in a ditch, flies buzzing around your eyes. Jericho, I hope that you die and your death comes soon. I'll stand over your grave and watch you as your Lord to your deathbed. And I'll stand over your grave to make sure that you're dead. And then once I'm done with that, I'll spit on your grave and you will be burning in hell. And if I ever see you in person, I am telling you on camera, and please don't edit this out, I will rip you from limb to limb. That's all I have to say about Chris Jericho.
Boy, that escalated quickly. I mean, that really got out of hand fast.
It's business time, baby.
The Solid Monster sounds off.
My client, Brock Lesnar, conquered the street.
This doesn't make any sense.
Your title belt is made of leather. You're not a real vegan.
He's fat. You haven't been beat up properly. Woo!
Welcome to episode 408 of the Solid Monster Sounds Off here for Sunday, November 8th. 2015, I am the Solemn Monster, and this is the 8-year anniversary episode. It was 8 years to the weekend that I first recorded the Sound Off, back when it was on SEScoops.com, and it was about 7 minutes long, I think, that first episode. Which, by the way, you can find that, and actually the first 10 episodes right now are up on our YouTube channel. I've combined episode 1 and 2, because episode 1 was so damn short. And to see the show grow by leaps and bounds since that time is just the coolest thing for me. And I have all of you guys to thank for that. It's amazing to me how many people who listen from that very first episode, from episode number 1, are still listening today. It's actually a lot of people. So I want to thank you guys first, because you guys are awesome. And everybody else who has helped make this podcast a labor of love for me. I enjoy doing it. Immensely. I probably enjoy doing it more than I do actually watching the wrestling that I'm talking about most weeks. It's just a great outlet for me, and as long as you guys are happy with it and it brings you some kind of joy in the course of your week, then that's all that matters. So I just want to say up front, thank you for 8 years. That's, for me anyway, it's a huge milestone, and there really are not that many podcasts out there. There are some, but not that many that can claim that they've been around for 8 years. And we're in a very, I think, small class, and that's a pretty cool thing. So thank you again to everybody. Also, thank you to What Culture. Got to give them a shout-out. I got tons of tweets from people sending me a link to their list of top 10 wrestling podcasts, and the Sound Off was on that list. Wrestling Soup, shout-out to them. They were on the list as well. Not a bad collection of choices on that list, so thank you to them. This is also the culmination of our top 8 countdown that I've been doing now for 8 weeks. 8 weeks ago, I started a countdown of 8 of my favorite WWE matches. These are not ranked in any particular order. They are not even necessarily the 8 favorites of mine of all time. They're 8 of my favorite WWE matches. And I tried to give the list a little bit of variety. So, you know, I'll have people saying, well, how come you didn't put this match on there since you love it so much? And how do you not put John Cena versus CM Punk on there for Money in the Bank, which you used to rave about? Yeah, I did rave about that, and that is one of my favorite matches, but it ain't on the list. So I tried to just give it some variety. I like, there's a whole host of different types of matches that WWE has done that I like. And this week, you know, we're going to get to the final match here in the countdown. And let me just say this. I have thoroughly enjoyed doing this, and it looks like you guys have enjoyed it too. I hate to see it end, but this is it. And we'll do match number 8 at the end of the podcast. It's a personal favorite of mine. It's one that I'm pretty sure nobody would guess if I gave you the chance to guess. It does not get a lot of attention. These guys had a couple of matches on pay-per-view that really were not very good at all. And so those matches kind of overshadow the first match that they ever had on TV. And it's a match that cannot be found on the network, but you can find it online. So we'll wrap this up later after the mailbag segment. Now, next week on the podcast, let me just mention this up front. Next week, actually this Friday coming up, marks the 10-year anniversary of the death of Eddie Guerrero. 10 years that he's been gone. It's hard to believe. So next week, we're going to talk about Eddie Guerrero on the podcast. I haven't quite worked out exactly what I'm going to do, if I'm going to talk about like some of his matches, if I'm going to do some kind of a ranking of his top 5 matches, or just talk about him for a little bit. I really haven't figured that out yet. Maybe you guys want to chime in, give some feedback. But we will be talking about him next weekend because we absolutely should be talking about Eddie Guerrero. We should be talking about Eddie Guerrero every week and not just on the anniversary of his death. But that is coming up next week, so I just wanted to mention that up front as well, so you guys don't think I forgot about it. Please keep supporting the podcast. Use our Audible link if you've got an audio book that you're looking to read. You can cash in for a free one. Sign up for 30 days using our link, audibletrial.com/Solomonster. I'm hoping to have a strong end here as we approach the end of 2015. We've been doing pretty good. Let's keep that up. So again, spread the link around, audibletrial.com/Solomonster. You can get one free audio book when you sign up. And you could also buy a shirt in our Pro Wrestling Tee store on ProWrestlingTees.com or make a PayPal donation on TheSolemnMonster.com. Like these fine gentlemen here, Jonathan Grandmaster Grunwald, Fast Blast Tim Banks, Jared the Fighter Frazier, Dark Despair Derek Graziano, Stephen Wise Guy Wysocki, and the Rebel Stanton Riker IV. Thank you, gentlemen, very much. I appreciate that. Again, make a PayPal donation anytime on TheSolemnMonster.com. $10 or more will get you a wrestling nickname. $30 or more will get you a nickname and a quick shout-out for your own podcast or YouTube channel. And there's a lot of people that listen to this show, so if you're looking to take advantage of that, that's the way to do it. Now let's get to the major news story of the week. And that is, of course, that Seth Rollins, WWE World Heavyweight Champion, no more. He has been stripped of the championship due to injury. He suffered a torn ACL, MCL, and medial meniscus in his right knee during a match with Kane on WWE's overseas tour. It took place at a show in Dublin, Ireland. There is cell phone footage online of what happened. He just landed wrong. It was a complete freak accident. He was doing a sunset flip out of the corner, you know, off the top rope, and he was going to then, I guess, powerbomb Kane through a table, which he did anyway. Rollins kept the match going for a little while longer. He powerbombed Kane, I think, through a table, then he gave him a pedigree. There's actually a video of him doing a pedigree, landing right on his knees. It pained me just to watch that, and I'm sure that probably added a good 2 or 3 months onto his recovery time. Not too bright, but he did finish the match. And again, he just landed wrong coming off that sunset flip. It looked very gnarly. You could clearly see the leg bent in a way it was not meant to bend. They're saying that it's going to keep him out anywhere from 6 to 9 months, but a lot of people familiar with those types of injuries are saying it's probably closer to a year. Obviously, this is devastating news all around. It's devastating for Rollins, who was in the midst of the biggest push of his career. He was in the middle of a pretty long reign as WWE champion. I don't know if it would have ended at Survivor Series or not. There were rumors that it was going to, but it's a pretty long run. Very, very similar to the run that Shawn Michaels had when he won the title of WrestleMania back in 96, and then he dropped it to Sid at Survivor Series. So I think Rollins, you know, his reign in some ways kind of mirrors the one that Shawn had back then. And it takes Rollins out of one of the biggest WrestleMania shows of all time. You know, they're going to try to pack 100,000 people in that stadium in Dallas next year. I don't know if they will be able to or not, but they're going to try, or at least claim that they did. He figured to play a major role on that show, and now that's out the window. I see some people celebrating, thank God, you know, Rollins was boring as champion, or you know, saying this is the best thing for Rollins because now he can come back as a babyface. Best thing for Rollins. The guy suffered a catastrophic knee injury that's going to keep him on the shelf for a year. It's going to cost him a ton of money. Best thing for Rollins. Yeah, if you're trying to say that, well, it can make things at Survivor Series more exciting, I agree. I agree. But to call it a good thing that happened to Rollins, I mean, I swear, there's a defect in people's brains that causes them to say stupid shit. I can't tell you how many times I saw that online in the last couple of days. He was by far the best in-ring performer in the company. You know, for all the criticism about how he's been booked as champion, and God knows I've had my share of things to say about that, nobody can touch the guy in the ring. I mean, he's that good. And an injury like this, he may never be the same again. I mean, this is a major, major injury. And it's major, especially for a guy with the kind of mobility in the ring that Rollins has. He's flying around and doing all kinds of dynamic shit. So for somebody like him, it's especially shitty to have that kind of major, major knee injury. And again, like I said, who knows when he comes back 9 months or a year from now, if he's going to be able to do the same things or have the same kind of speed and all that kind of stuff that he had before. I don't know. You know, he may not. He may be a step or two off. Now, WWE has to plan for the next year without the guy. For them, the injury could not have come at a worse time. They have John Cena taking time off. It was just announced that Randy Orton is going to be out 4 to 6 months with a partially torn rotator cuff. He's probably getting surgery. Daniel Bryan, still not clear to wrestle by WWE as far as we know. And now Rollins is gone. He's out of the picture. And the lack of depth at the top of the roster becomes even more apparent. We've talked about this a lot before, and now you see the list of injuries, and there's a lot of other people who are out hurt too. You can put Tyson Kidd on that list, you could put Rusev on that list, although he should be back in a few weeks. But at the very top of the card, that's where it kills them. And Cena's not hurt, but he's gone, and when you take all of these things and you put them together and they all happen at the same time, you know, that's when it comes back to bite you on the ass. And for the lack of depth and all the even Steven booking for so long, now they're paying the price for it. You know, I was going through the baby faces and the heels on the main roster. I went on WWE.com, and I went through all the baby faces and the heels and putting together the tournament stuff that we're going to get to here in a second, and it really hit me how few real stars they have. Even with the guys who are out hurt, even if they're not hurt and they're on the roster right now, the star power just isn't there. It's unbelievable how thin they are at the top. Now, they've announced that a tournament is going to be held at Survivor Series, a la the Deadly Game from 1998, and they're going to crown a new WWE champion that night. And that's where, you know, for as bad as this is for WWE, with injury comes opportunity. The product has largely been stagnant for months now. The last couple of weeks of Raw have not been bad, but that's just 2 weeks. Okay, how many months now has that show been just horribly, horribly boring? Okay, they're just in a rut. Ratings continue to fall little by little. It sounds like they set new records every week now as far as how low the Raw audience is, right? 1 week, oh, it's the second lowest Raw number in 17 years going back to the Attitude Era. Then this week, it's the lowest number in 18 years. They're setting records week after week. It's not the kind of records they're looking to set, though. And I love the excuses, oh, it's the baseball game, it's the football game, and yeah, football does hurt, but, you know, football game, like there isn't a football game every year. Monday Night Football is not a new phenomenon, it's around every year. They weren't setting records last year. Why are they setting them this year and not last year, the year before? But WWE now has the chance to turn a negative into a positive, because all of a sudden, Survivor Series just got a hell of a lot more interesting than it was a week ago. People are very curious to see how this thing plays out, if somebody new gets elevated, if somebody new debuts, if someone's turning heel. If you're WWE, you know, what do? Do you get on the phone to John Cena and you call him back early? I mean, I'm sure that call's already been made. I don't think he is going to come back early. You know, but you got Brock Lesnar. He's another one. Do they call him and throw a bunch of money at him to work Survivor Series? And as much as I love Brock Lesnar, and I ranted all those weeks ago when Raw was just at its worst about how we need all hands on deck, bring back Sting, bring back Lesnar, get some star power back on that show, bringing back a bunch of big names for this tournament is not the answer. Bringing back John Cena is not the answer. I don't want him in there. Bringing Brock Lesnar back for this is not the answer. I'd rather they stick to whatever plans they had for him. If that means Brock is not back on TV until January, then fine, keep him out until January. Daniel Bryan, I see people saying, I guess they gotta rush Daniel Bryan back early. The guy is not medically cleared. What don't people understand about that? Don't you think that if they were swerving everybody and had already cleared the guy, as low as their numbers have been getting, they'd have brought him back by now? I mean, what do you think they're waiting for? You think they knew this was going to happen to Rollins, and they have Daniel Bryan locked in a fucking closet somewhere and under lock and key, and now they're just going to, you know, open the lock and bring him out like an animal? I mean, I don't understand. He's out because he's still not medically cleared. Seth Rollins being hurt does not mean they can just throw the guy back into the ring. If he's legitimately not cleared, they can't just bring him back because somebody else got hurt. That's not how this works. If Bryan were actually ready to come back, I'd say, great. If you're okay with turning Roman Reigns heel, I can't think of a better way to get heat on him than having him and Bryan go all the way to the finals, only for Roman to turn and to screw him out of the championship. Imagine the fucking heat this guy would get if they did that. If the plan, though, is to stick with Roman Reigns, babyface hero, bringing back Daniel Bryan for this tournament would be about the dumbest fucking thing they could possibly do. It would be the Royal Rumble all over again. But the fact is, Bryan, as far as we all know, is not cleared. So he doesn't factor into any of this, as far as I'm concerned. And if they did suddenly clear him simply because they need a big name, then boy, boy does that expose their wellness policy as a sham. And I don't think it is. I don't think it's a sham. So I would keep John Cena away. I would keep Brock Lesnar away. And Daniel Bryan, to me, is a non-factor as far as I'm concerned. No phone calls to Batista, no phone calls to Chris Jericho. Just run with what you have. You made your bed, now you got to lay in it and work with the pieces that you have. So given all of these circumstances, I thought, what better way to start here on this 8-year anniversary show than by doing a little bit of fantasy booking and booking ourselves a tournament for the WWE Championship here on the Sound Off. I wouldn't even mind them bringing back the whole Deadly Game name that they used at Survivor Series back in 98 if it means we get that awesome giant skull back as an entrance, right? How cool was that fucking thing? I'm sure they've got that locked away in their warehouse somewhere. I don't see why they can't use it again. You know, or maybe it's got the old logo on there. Just have a new one made. How much could that possibly cost? I miss those old sets. Anyway. What they call this tournament is the least of their worries right now. I think the one-night 16-man format they used for that tournament back in 98, which is the same format they used back at WrestleMania 4 when they had the championship tournament on that show, and it was the same problem then, it's just too much. It's just too many matches to do in one night. I do like the 16-man format, though. And so what I would do is I would have a 16-man bracket with qualifying matches that start this week, as in tomorrow night, on Raw. And then you end up with the standard 8-man bracket, and all of those matches, you do them on the pay-per-view. I was never a fan of WWE doing the King of the Ring and only doing the semifinals and the finals on the pay-per-view. I thought that was crap. It means a lot more if you have somebody who has to go through three guys in one night instead of two. That's why I like doing the 8-man format in one night, but 16 is just too much. Now, they've already planted the seeds for a traditional Survivor Series elimination match, which they haven't officially announced yet, so they could always change plans. But I assume we're going to get that match. It's going to be the Wyatt family against Kane and The Undertaker. I would presume two other partners. I mean, I guess you could do a handicap match. I wouldn't. So if they have two other partners, I mean, I'm not even going to venture a guess what their original plan may have been as far as who was going to be in that match and how this tournament now affects that. Maybe now they plug the Dudley boys in there. You know, they'd have themselves a whole Attitude Era team, Kane and The Undertaker and the Dudley boys. But, you know, that could be good too if they want to use that as a setup for a program maybe coming out of the pay-per-view with the Dudleys against Harper and Rowan or Harper and Strowman. The Dudleys and the Wyatts, I think, make sense as a feud coming out of Survivor Series, especially now that they're out of the tag team title picture. But whoever their partners are, I think it keeps those guys out of the tournament, at least on the pay-per-view. I do have Bray Wyatt plugged into a qualifier here in my plans. One person actually sent me a tweet. He suggested that they just have Undertaker win the title since it's the 25th anniversary of his debut, and then he can hold it for a couple of months and drop it at the Rumble. I have no interest in seeing Undertaker as WWE champion ever again. And I think you keep him separate from the tournament so that you have two hooks for Survivor Series instead of just one. I think that's the smarter way to go. As far as the tournament, here's how I've set this thing up. Qualifiers would begin on Raw tomorrow night. You've got Bray Wyatt against Cesaro. I don't know that we've seen that match before, so it kind of intrigues me. Cesaro gets the win off the distraction by Kane and or The Undertaker. I would expect to see one or both of them on TV this week to set up the match anyway at Survivor Series. And all they have to do is come out. They could play mind games with Wyatt, set some shit on fire, a couple of lightning bolts, you know, whatever. And that's enough for Cesaro to take advantage, hit a big move, steal the pin. Now notice, I am pitching a distraction finish here, which may seem a little odd given how much I fucking despise them. What I despise, though, is how often they do them. Okay, I've always said that. A well-placed distraction is fine here and there. But WWE, they have no self-control, right? They find something and they do it once. Oh, that was nice. Let's do it every fucking week. And then they just drive it into the ground. That's what I have a problem with. But I think here in this case, you know, I'm not pitching a distraction roll-up. Let's make that very clear. It's okay. It's a distraction that leads to a finish and a win for Cesaro, okay? Perfect. It adds fuel to the Wyatt Undertaker stuff. It gets Cesaro into the first round of the tournament. The other matches over the next couple of weeks, I would do Ziggler over Sheamus. I would do Ambrose over Barrett. Owens over Ryback. Let's put the final nail in that feud once and for all. Big Show over Miz. I know, Big Show, but just bear with me. We'll get back to him in a second. I would force Big E and Kofi Kingston to wrestle each other in a qualifying match. I think that could be very entertaining. And that one ends up going to a draw. So neither guy qualifies, and that leaves New Day open to do something else on the pay-per-view, maybe an elimination match. Alberto Del Rio over Damian Sandow. Just to give Sandow some TV time, for Christ's sake, I mean, when was the last time we even saw this guy on Raw? You know, that's a guy that needs to be rehabbed, and that takes time. You can't just plug him into the tournament, you know, for the WWE Championship and send him to the second round or send him to the finals. I'm sure people, send Damian Sandow to the finals. It doesn't work that way, okay? Hey, look, if I were in charge, I would come up with a plan to rehab Sandow because I think there's something there, and I think he's been screwed. But this is not the time to do that. But at least get him on TV, you know, put him in a qualifying match. Del Rio wins, and you know, he advances. And then I would do Tyler Breeze against Neville, which is a match we've seen on NXT before. We know those guys can have a fun match. Let him have one on Raw. Let him have one on SmackDown. Tyler Breeze wins. He goes over. Roman Reigns gets a bye directly into the tournament without having to qualify because he won that Fatal 4-Way match a couple of weeks ago. Just like Bret Hart. Bret Hart did not have to qualify to get into that King of the Ring tournament in 1993. They just put him in there. And so Roman Reigns, who in a way is getting screwed anyway, kind of, because he already became the number one contender, now he's got to wrestle a whole tournament. But, you know, if you just do a tournament to determine who faces Roman, that's not as exciting. So I love the idea of doing a full-blown tournament, but at the very least, the guy deserves a bye into the first round. So, these are the brackets I would go with at Survivor Series. Roman Reigns against Big Show. Del Rio against Cesaro. Ambrose against Tyler Breeze. And Dolph Ziggler against Kevin Owens. Which I know they just did on Monday, but it was a good match, so I don't mind seeing it again. With these brackets, the way they're set up, you're also teasing the idea that Tyler Breeze and Dolph Ziggler are going to win their matches, because if they do, they get matched up in the second round. And that's been the feud lately, right? But I actually wouldn't do that match here. I guess I'd kind of swerve people into thinking you're going to do that match, but don't actually do it here. I would save that first match for another show. I would have Ambrose beat Breeze, but do it by DQ. Not a clean win. Tyler should not be eating a clean win this early in his run. You know, let him use the selfie stick or something, whatever. And it fits the character. He gets himself, he's desperate, whatever. He gets himself DQ'd. Ambrose advances to meet the winner of Ziggler and Owens. I would have Owens go over with the pop-up powerbomb clean. You know, they already did the distraction finish with Breeze last Monday, so you don't want to do the same thing twice as far as a finish is concerned. That sets up Ambrose versus Owens in the semifinals, and it keeps the Intercontinental Champion looking strong by not bouncing him out of this thing in the first round. So let's move up the bracket a little bit here. We have Del Rio and Cesaro. This is a match I told you guys a few weeks ago when Del Rio came back I would love to see. I think Del Rio and Cesaro would match up very well, and I think Del Rio and Brock Lesnar down the road could also be a fun match. So I would do Del Rio and Cesaro here. I feel like their styles would mesh very well. These are two guys that I'm guessing would probably lay it in pretty stiff on one another. I think it could be a fun match. As big of a Cesaro supporter as I am, though, because I'm sure there's already people thinking, oh, he's going to send this fucking guy to the finals, isn't he? I would have Cesaro go over here, and I would send him to the semifinals. I would not send him to the finals. But I do think, again, looking beyond Survivor Series, this is not just a match. I think it's potentially a great program to have Del Rio and Cesaro feuding for the U.S. title. And there's a tie-in there with Zeb. Zeb, of course, used to manage Cesaro, so they can weave that in there as well. What I would do is I would do this match. I would not give Cesaro a decisive win, like he just beats Del Rio clean with his move. He can win with some kind of wacky cradle. He has that wacky cradle that he's beaten some people with before. And he gets the surprise win over Del Rio. And Del Rio can't believe it. I'm sure people are going crazy. Yeah, they're so happy to see Cesaro win. And Del Rio attacks him after the match. Beats him down. Maybe puts him in the armbar. We haven't seen him use the armbar, really, since he came back. So he puts him in the armbar and works him over until the referees, you know, pull him off. And he's not so hurt that he can't wrestle in the second round. But obviously, you know, Cesaro would be favoring his arm in the match later on against Roman, which Roman would win. There would be no interference or anything like that. Roman would beat him clean. And it sets up the Del Rio-Cesaro program for the U.S. title coming out of the pay-per-view. It gives those two guys something to do. It gives Cesaro something meaningful to do. It gives Del Rio a good opponent, one that he hasn't faced before. I like that. I like that idea. So Cesaro meets the winner of Roman Reigns against Big Show. This is, I'm sure, where people are just pulling their hair out. You're booking Roman Reigns against the Big Show. Again, what is wrong with you? There is a method to my madness. I mean, come on, you know me better than this. There's a method to the madness here. What I would do, and I don't know if WWE would do this, but I would have Big Show taken out backstage before the match by a mystery person. Roman comes out for his match. He's waiting to see who he's going to face, and out comes Baron Corbin. I have really liked what I've seen from Baron Corbin on NXT the last few months. I think he's improved a lot. I think they need to get some new guys up. I mean, you look at the lack of depth they have right now. I think it's pretty fucking obvious they got to bring some new guys up. And that's not something that actually sits well with me because I don't have faith that they bring up these NXT guys that are going to know what to do with most of them. But you reach a point where you got no choice. And so you want to bring some new blood up. And I think him taking out Big Show, even though, you know, we don't see it on camera, it gives the guy some credibility right out of the gate. And I know it's the Big Show, but still, you know, it's like Corbin's like saying, fuck you, I'm taking your spot. I would have Roman go over, obviously, but I don't think Corbin loses that much by taking the loss here. You know, he establishes himself as a force right out of the gate on day one. That's why I would do it that way with him taking out Big Show instead of just randomly having Baron Corbin show up as the mystery entrant. Because it shows this guy is hungry, he's tired of waiting for his opportunity, and maybe it'll turn him babyface because he's sparing us another Roman Reigns Big Show match. Maybe it would blow up in my face and they would all cheer Baron Corbin. Actually, they probably would if they hate Roman Reigns, but I would still do it that way, and Roman wins. That sets up your two semifinal matches. Roman Reigns against Cesaro and Kevin Owens against Dean Ambrose. Roman beats Cesaro. Ambrose beats Owens in what I'm sure would be a hell of a match, and they've been teasing a feud lately between them for the IC belt. So Ambrose wins that match, and that sets up the finals. Roman Reigns against Dean Ambrose. To me, that's the money match right there. And you do it now because one of them is turning. And so this may be the one and only time you can do this whole babyface versus babyface thing by, you know, putting the two of them in the ring together. Now, some people may ask, why does somebody have to turn? Does somebody always have to turn heel? besides just trying to shake things up a little bit, Seth Rollins was the top heel in the company. Whatever you think about the way he's been booked, he was positioned as the number one heel in WWE. And now he's gone. You need someone to step in and replace him. Which means somebody, unless you look, you could take a Kevin Owens. I wouldn't be against the idea of giving Kevin Owens a shot. If Kevin Owens didn't already have the Intercontinental title, I might have considered him. But the timing, I think, for him just isn't right. And I don't want to screw up whatever plans they may have for him and Sami Zayn when Sami Zayn comes back. Because I firmly believe when Sami Zayn is ready to come back, he ain't going to NXT. He's going to show up on the main roster as a surprise to screw over Kevin Owens and probably wrestle him for the championship. I don't want to fuck that up. You got to have multiple programs, you know, plan for the future here. You can't fuck everything else up just because this one went haywire. So I just think for Kevin Owens, the timing just isn't what it needs to be. But yeah, you can take, he's a strong heel. You could, if you had a strong enough heel that you could just plug into that spot, yes, you can do that. I just don't see who else that would be right now. And I think to shake things up a little bit, in this case, a turn is not the worst idea in the world. In fact, I think it's the way to go. You need a new top heel. John Cena will never turn, okay? We know this already. John Cena will never turn, and WWE has a lot of good reasons for not wanting to go down that road. You don't need two John Cenas, though. And that's why, and I considered it both ways. I even, at first on Twitter, I pitched it the other way, but then I thought more about it. Of the two, Reigns and Ambrose, you know, I would pull the trigger and turn Roman, is what I would do. Now, like I said, originally on Twitter, I suggested Dean be the one to take the shortcut, let Dean Ambrose be the one to turn heel and maybe hook up with the Authority and get the championship. The idea of corporate Ambrose is just, it's so wrong. It's just so wrong. I really don't even want the Authority involved all that much here, to be honest with you. I would rather start phasing them out. But I thought of Ambrose for the turn first because A, he's fucking unstable, and he would do something like that. And B, I still do believe the real money long term is in Dean Ambrose as a heel, just like I think Seth Rollins is going to be a great babyface when he comes back. But whichever way you do this, I mean, neither of them are bad options. So if your plan, if you're listening to this right now, you're like, oh, Solomonster, I disagree. I would turn Dean Ambrose heel. Cool. You can't go wrong with either one. I think both ways it works out pretty well. Neither are bad options. Dean going heel might make for the better story, given that, you know, he's taken a backseat recently to Roman Reigns, and maybe he's tired of it. And also, remember, in the beginning of the year, when he was in Titan Tower, remember that one Raw show where there was some kind of, there was like a snowstorm, and they had to do the whole show from Titan Tower? And they did this goofy thing where Dean Ambrose showed up, and he said he wanted to see his face on the wall inside Titan Tower. I mean, I know storyline consistency is not exactly WWE's strong suit, but, you know, there's a story there that can be told. It could absolutely work. You put the title on Ambrose, Reigns is scarred by the betrayal, goes silent for a few months, which, if you keep Reigns babyface, I still firmly believe silent but deadly is the way to go with the guy, and then you build to him taking the championship at WrestleMania. But, and this is why I changed my mind that I'm going to go with Roman turning heel. Of the two, Dean Ambrose is the more popular one. Obviously, he's more widely accepted as a fan favorite. And at some point, you got to stop fighting against the waves and just go with it. You know, just go with it. They had to be dragged kicking and screaming before they finally gave the ball to Daniel Bryan and they pushed him to that very, very top spot. People are ready to embrace Dean Ambrose as a top face. They have been for a while now. I don't realistically expect WWE to ever run with him as the top face. But I think they should. And they should at least give him the chance to run with it and see how he does. Take a chance. You know, grow some balls. The guy's already being cheered. I mean, I hear myself saying take a chance. I kind of shake my head. Are you really even taking that much of a risk by giving this guy the chance to be the top babyface? Oh boy, you know, we're taking a real gamble here. I mean, this fucking guy is being cheered everywhere he goes. Like a year ago, wasn't there a big story about how he, like a Dean Ambrose hoodie had outdrawn John Cena in merchandise or something? There's real, tangible potential here with this guy. It's really not that much of a risk, if you think about it. It's pretty fucking simple. You know, Roman, if he goes heel, you don't need to do silent but deadly. As a babyface, you have to, because those babyface promos are just killing him. But as a heel, the rules are different. What I would do is have a good back and forth, you know, competitive match. We get a ref bump. Out come the Usos, who give the surprise assist to Roman Reigns by attacking Ambrose, or they trip him. They do something. They do something to screw him over. They just came back on Raw this week. Okay, Jey Uso was out for like 6 months with a knee injury. It's not obvious that Roman is even aware of what's going on when this happens, or that he endorses them getting involved, but it leads to Roman Reigns winning the match, and he becomes the new WWE champion. Now, how I would probably do it, you could go off the air that way. Okay, just end it there. We've got a new champion, but we're left wondering what the hell just happened. There's a lot of confusion. Did Roman know? You know, did he ask the Usos to come out and help him? You can save the turn for the next night on Raw. Have Ambrose come out all pissed off at the beginning of the show, looking for the Usos, getting up in Roman's face, asking him, you know, if he knew anything about what happened, what's up with his boys. You know, and Roman can deny it. They can call out the Usos. This all leads to an Usos against Roman Reigns and Dean Ambrose match. And that's where you make it official. That's where Roman shows his true colors. You know, Dean was like family, but the Usos are his family. I think aligning Reigns with the Usos, who they've acknowledged now on TV as his family, they've said they're cousins, you're pushing the Usos up to that next level. They're kind of played out, I think, as baby faces anyway. They just came back. You could just have them do the same thing they were doing before. I mean, they're over, and that's fine. But again, it's a little played out to me. I know some people are sick and tired of the Usos, so why not put a fresh coat of paint on them and see how they can do? You know, one thing I was kind of surprised they didn't do when Jey was gone, I know they had Jimmy doing commentary and stuff just to kill Tom until his brother came back. But, you know, from what little bit I've seen of Jimmy on Total Divas, which is really just clips here and there, but even, you know, even on TV on occasion when they let him speak, I mean, he's got personality. And I actually think, you know, maybe if they gave him the chance to, you know, to be a heel, he can kind of be the mouthpiece for that team. I get the impression Jey Uso is not, he's not as outgoing as his brother. But I think, you know, heel Usos maybe with Jimmy being the one to kind of carry the, you know, the promo part of that. I think that could work. I mean, again, sometimes a fresh coat of paint on something is all you need. You have an act that's kind of stale, they're kind of played out, you want to try something different. And in this case, you have the family connection between them and Roman, right? Roman even recruited them to be part of his team on Monday in that Survivor Series elimination match. So you're elevating them to that next level, you're freshening them up a little bit, but you're also giving Roman the chance to surround himself with other people, which I think will be good for him. He's one of these guys who I think works better when he has other people to play off of, and he's not just by himself. That's what makes the banter between him and Dean Ambrose so entertaining. You do that without having to shoehorn him into the Authority as their new poster boy. He can be loosely aligned with the Authority going forward. You know, maybe the Authority is behind Roman as champion. They like what they see. They like what he did at Survivor Series. You know, he did what he had to do to grab the brass ring or whatever fucking phrase they want to use. And they could be behind him. They can endorse him as their champion or whatever. But he doesn't actually have to be in the Authority. I hate everything having to revolve around being in the Authority, and they're the lapdogs of the Authority. I think they could have a loose association with them. They can kind of be with them, but not really. I wouldn't just want to put all these guys in the Authority. Now, one aspect to this, and I just thought of this a little while ago, thinking forward, right? The rumor for WrestleMania for a long time has been that it's going to be The Rock wrestling Triple H, and I'm okay with that. You know, it's been long enough. We haven't seen these two guys in the ring. I have no problem if they want to do Rock and Triple H at WrestleMania. That may be the one Triple H match I don't mind them doing. But how do you get there? Do they already have a story? Do they know how they're going to get there? If that's the match, I don't know. But you can tie this into the whole thing if you wanted to. You know, they could bring The Rock back at some point to confront Roman Reigns and say, "Hey, brother, what's going on here? What are you doing? You know, you turned on your brother here, Dean Ambrose. You're tearing shit up here in the company." And Rock comes back to try to talk some sense into him. And I know it's a risk if you put Roman Reigns in a promo battle with The Rock. Okay, it's probably a battle he's going to lose. But again, as a heel, we've never really had the chance to see what Roman Reigns can do on the microphone as a heel if you just let him go out there and be himself. So maybe Roman gets up in his face and says, "You got a lot of balls telling me about how it is and about what I did when you did the exact same thing 17 years ago, 18 years ago. You know, I can envision a segment like that where they're going back and forth. And Triple H, again, even if Roman Reigns is not part of the authority, if he's got the Triple H stamp of approval and Triple H is getting in this guy's head, maybe Rock doesn't like that. And Rock's like, "Hey, you know, you need to stay out of this." And Triple H is trying to stir up shit between The Rock and his cousin. Maybe that's the link. Maybe that's the impetus for a Rock-Triple H match at WrestleMania if they want to tie Rock into this somehow. So it was just something I thought about before when I was thinking about WrestleMania. But I like the idea of Reigns and the Usos as this new Samoan squad. You know, like the Samoan hit squad looking out for each other, tearing shit up. And meanwhile, Dean Ambrose is chasing Roman for the championship. Okay, he can chase him for a few months. You could even call that group the Roman Empire. I know that's what they call Roman Reigns, his fan base, but I think that'd be a pretty cool name for their group, or even just the Empire. I think there's money in a Dean Ambrose chase. You know, maybe a Royal Rumble win for Ambrose. People want to see him win the title at that point because they don't like Roman Reigns to begin with. The tide has been turning a little bit in recent weeks. The reactions to Reigns have been a little bit better. But the moment he fucks over Dean Ambrose, he will be the most hated man on the planet because he will have turned on somebody that people chose to like and not somebody who was force-fed to them. And by the way, there's a potential Team Bad tie-in with this group also. You've got Tamina. Okay, another Samoan. I'm pretty sure she's part of that family too, although I gave up trying to make sense of that family tree a long time ago. You've got Naomi, who's married to Jimmy Uso, and can be his valet. The more intriguing thing to me, though, is Sasha Banks and where she fits in here. You could always do a deal where if Sasha is just that over, and you want to turn her, Team Bad could always attack her, and Sasha can just go off on her own. I'm kind of intrigued, though, at the idea of maybe including Sasha as part of all this. I mean, she has no direct connection to any of these guys, but boy, I mean, I do like the idea of her being associated with the new top group in the company, because that means more screen time for her, it means more time for her to show off her personality as a heel. I do think Sasha is better as a heel than a babyface. At the end of the day, I mean, the fans are going to dictate what they want her to be. And I'm not even saying they all have to be part of the group right away. That's six people. I think that's a little too much. But I think there's definitely a tie-in that you could explore even a couple of months down the road. There's a lot of possibilities there. And so there you go. Everyone's coming up with a million and one different ideas about what WWE can do here. My idea is just one. Now keep in mind that WWE's track record with tournaments is awful. They do not do tournaments well at all. I have a feeling a lot of these fantasy scenarios we're all coming up with may end up being a lot better and a lot more exciting than what WWE actually ends up doing. But they have a real chance to try some things here. You know, putting the title on Roman Reigns may not be everybody's idea of really shaking things up because it's so freaking obvious. But sometimes all it takes is one little tweak to change everything. That and putting their muscle behind somebody like Ambrose, who the people have been begging for a reason to get behind. The guy still gets cheered. He shouldn't. Look at the way he's been booked. He's just kind of been floating around aimlessly for months with really nothing to do. But they have a chance to change that here. But one thing is clear to me. For all the times they started pushing somebody and they stopped, for all the same matches they would give us over and over and over again, week after week after week, and not get anybody new over at that top level, now they're paying the price for it. When half the roster goes down due to injury, that's when it really kicks them in the ass, and they have no one to blame for that but themselves. A guy like Dolph Ziggler, think about where he was a year ago. Ironically, because Roman Reigns went down with an injury. He hurt his groin. Injury creates opportunity. Dolph Ziggler, sole survivor, with a little help from Sting. Sole Survivor in that Survivor Series match. The Authority is gone! 5 weeks later, the Authority was back. just in case you thought stipulations meant something in this company. And Dolph Ziggler was fired. He was fired in that stupid storyline, and they completely squandered whatever momentum that the guy had. Pick somebody and stick with them. If that's Roman Reigns, fine. But they need a strong heel to replace Rollins, and that might just be the thing that he needs. Raw last Monday night was live from Denver, Colorado. Our Raw Instapoll on Twitter the day after the show. 834 votes, 61% thumbs up to 39% thumbs down. So basically a 60-40 split. A little closer than it was the week before, but you know, still overall a good show. They set up a 5-on-5 Survivor Series elimination main event. Team Rollins against Team Reigns. All feels so pointless now, doesn't it? Kevin Owens and Dolph Ziggler, I thought, had a good match. Pop-up powerbomb off the distraction by Tyler Breeze. After the match, Breeze attacked Dolph, laid him out with the beauty shot. Rollins asked Owens to be on his team, and he agreed. But he said, "You owe me one." CM Punk has heard that one before. Cesaro beat The Miz after a 20-rep giant swing into a sharpshooter for the tap out. As dominant a win for Cesaro as we've seen in a long time. But then they cut to Stardust and the Legion of Losers in the crowd, just to remind you of his place on the card, in case you forgot. I do like my idea, though, better for a Del Rio-Cesaro U.S. title feud, but anyway. Bray Wyatt came out with the family for a promo that saw him summon lightning and thunderbolts inside the arena. So he has inherited the Undertaker and Kane's magical powers. What a shame, all those magical powers, yet he still can't use them to win a match. The Lucha Dragons beat Sheamus and King Barrett when Kalisto pinned Barrett off the Salida del Sol. They even aired a vignette for the Lucha Dragons before the match to build them up, something I just criticized them last week for never doing on Raw, when they do it very effectively on NXT all the time. So I guess my timing was impeccable here. Backstage, Jack Swagger returned from the dead and confronted Zeb Coulter about what he's doing now with Del Rio. And Coulter told him it's time for the U.S. and Mexico to unite. And Del Rio walked in and told Swagger to get lost. Just what we need. Another Alberto Del Rio versus Jack Swagger feud. You know, the more I think about this, their idea is to go with Del Rio and Swagger, possibly, right? And Cesaro and Stardust. Tell me my idea isn't better. Come on. Let's just cut the fat. Take the two guys that people want to see go head-to-head and just put them in a feud. We don't need Swagger. Stardust can do something else. Give us Alberto and Cesaro. It's a better feud. It's a better feud. It's a better match. It's people that we can actually kind of sort of care about. Ugh. And just think, these two here in this segment, Del Rio and Swagger, who may yet again be on a collision course, once wrestled for the world championship at a WrestleMania. But then again, Miz headlined a WrestleMania as the champion, and he won. Against John Cena, no less. Del Rio had a match with R-Truth on the show, and all that momentum I talked about him having last week came to a screeching halt. Nobody gave a shit about this match. This was the point in the show where even I started to doze off. And this was not a terrible show, but I just started falling asleep. So I was in and out of consciousness here for this match, but I know Del Rio won with the foot stomp again off the top rope to the face. Throughout the night, they were airing Survivor Series flashbacks. The first one they showed was from the very first Survivor Series in 1987. Team Savage against Team Honky, which sounds awfully racist, but is actually quite accurate. All white dudes on the team. That was the first one they showed. Then they showed highlights from the Team Raw versus Team SmackDown match, I think from 2005. And then something rather odd. They showed highlights from last year of Dolph Ziggler pinning all the heels to oust the Authority from power for all of 5 weeks. What's odd about it was no Sting. They never showed him. They never mentioned him in this package here. It was like the guy didn't even exist. I mean, and it was a pretty big moment, him debuting finally after all this time in WWE, and it led directly to the finish, which then led to Sting against Triple H at this year's WrestleMania. So the fact they would omit the guy is very, very strange to me. Now, JBL openly mentioned Sting by name a few segments before this, so it's not like Sting is on their shit list now for some reason. It's just very weird. Very, very weird, the editing of this video package here. It's like it never even happened. That was the one big thing about Survivor Series last year, and it's like, poof, never happened. Backstage, the New Day volunteered to be on Team Rollins in the main event, and Rollins reluctantly accepted. The three of them rocking out in the ring later on to Rollins' music when he came out was just the best thing I saw all week. And then Kevin Owens coming out and staring at the New Day with this look of bewilderment on his face was probably the second best thing. So, God bless the New Day. Main event was Roman Reigns, Dean Ambrose, Ryback and the Usos against Seth Rollins, Kevin Owens, and the New Day in a traditional Survivor Series elimination match. This was the Usos' surprise return, teaming up with their cuz. Xavier was gone about 30 seconds in after a top rope splash by the Usos came down to Roman Reigns and Dean Ambrose against Seth Rollins and Kevin Owens. Once Owens was pinned by Ambrose, Rollins tried to bail, but they stopped him. He ended up hitting Ambrose with a chair for the cheap DQ. Then threw Roman Reigns into the ring, but Rollins ate a Superman punch and then bailed. He got the hell out of Dodge. It was a good show, like I said, not as good as the week before, but there's been an improvement without John Cena, without Randy Orton. I'm not saying it's because of them. It's not because John Cena is not on the show. I mean, if anything, I was enjoying the John Cena Open Challenge stuff. I thought the show might actually suffer because of it. I guess the one good thing about him not being there that is reflected in these shows is that it forces them to put the spotlight on somebody else. In this case, it's Roman Reigns, so I'm sure some people still hate that. But, you know, the shows certainly have not gotten worse. You can throw all of this out the window, though, now with the Rollins injury. The most important night right now for this company is going to be November 23rd. November 23rd is the Raw after Survivor Series. That show will tell the tale about where WWE is headed, I think, for the next few months. So that's going to be a very important night. One last news item here, WWE related, before we move on to NXT. For those keeping score, superstar Billy Graham is now back in the good graces of WWE. He took to his Facebook page this week to announce that he has signed a Legends contract with the company, and they are apparently going to begin selling merchandise for him next year. It's amazing how your perspective changes when they wave a large wad of money in your face, isn't it? Here's a guy who was one of the most famous names of all time. Hulk Hogan jacked his shit. Jesse Ventura ripped off his shtick. You know you're good when other people are copying what you're doing. Then he went on Donahue. He accused Pat Patterson of molesting young boys, which he later admitted he made up. Hell of a thing to make up about somebody, by the way. He was on bad terms with the company for years and years and years, and then they welcomed him back with open arms. And they put him in the Hall of Fame, which he then turned around and sold his Hall of Fame ring on eBay, because he didn't want to be in the same Hall of Fame as Abdullah the Butcher. Don't ask me. Just don't even bother trying to figure this out. They did a book for him. They did a DVD about his career. They put him on the payroll for a few years. $2,000 a month they were paying this guy as a consultant. I would love to know what he was consulting on. So when WWE was doing budget cuts, they cut him. They looked at who they were paying and the money that was going out, and they said, we don't need to pay this guy anymore. He's not doing anything. So they cut him. Now, I do think WWE also told him that he wouldn't be allowed to use his name and his likeness anymore, which, you know, if that's true, that's a dick move. Okay, I'll give him that. And I think that may have stemmed from him speaking out on the drug use and wrestling after the Benoit stuff happened. So I'm sure that did not sit well with the upper echelon of WWE, having this guy go out on TV every single night and railing against the drug abuses in the pro wrestling industry. Which, when you say pro wrestling industry to the mainstream media, they automatically just think WWE. It's like when you say mixed martial arts, what does the mainstream media think of? UFC. Because they're the biggest organization, so they bear the brunt whenever something bad happens. So he gets cut from the payroll. He's no longer getting his $2,000 a month check from WWE. And so Superstar turns around and says Vince McMahon is going to burn in hell. Now, this is coming from the same guy who once said Chris Jericho would die and drown in his own blood. Fast forward to a few months back. Dusty Rhodes passes away. And this guy writes a letter to Vince McMahon The evil dude that he said is going to burn in hell, by the way. Not for all the other bad shit that Vince McMahon, I'm sure, has done in his life, but because he canceled Billy Graham's $2,000 a month contract and wouldn't let him use his name anymore. That's why he's going to burn in hell. He writes Vince a letter, and I talked about this on the Sound Off at that time, asking for Dusty Rhodes' old job as promo coach. He wanted Dusty's old job at the Performance Center. And it sounds and looks like Vince McMahon had enough sense to ignore the email, as I had hoped he would. Now he has worked out a Legends deal through Triple H, because Triple H is just trying to make up with everybody that Vince McMahon has apparently given up on. Vince McMahon gave up on trying to make amends with Bruno. It's never going to happen, and Triple H made it happen. He gave up on Warrior. Triple H made up with Warrior. Now Billy Graham. I swear, you know, they should send Triple H to the Middle East. He may be the only man who can bring peace between the Israelis and the Palestinians. Only Triple H can bring Sunni and Shiite together. He should run for president. He's the only guy who can bring Democrats and Republicans together to actually get stuff done and do their fucking job. So on his Facebook page, superstar Billy Graham wrote, "Miracles do happen." So now he's back, and I guess that means Vince McMahon is saved from eternal damnation.
I'm actually not wearing pants, and that's how I watch NXT every single week.
NXT this week opened with an amazing match. Asuka came out for a match against Cameron. We have not seen Cameron for a while. This was her NXT debut. And they faced off. There is an amazing spot in this match that if you have not seen it, you have to go on the network and check it out. Right this minute, pause the podcast and go see it, because I still can't believe what I saw. They're standing there, and Cameron goes and throws a slap at Asuka. Basically, she does slap her. But Asuka grabs her arm as she comes in for the slap and does like a jumping, rolling arm bar. It was amazing. Just out of nowhere. Completely unexpected. First move of the match, really, or one of the first moves in the match. It was awesome. And so, obviously, Asuka got the win with her crossface chicken wing lock. Cameron, for her part, did not look terrible, but how much of that was Cameron not being that bad, and how much of that was Asuka being that damn good? I'm going to guess the reason Cameron did not look that bad here had more to do with Asuka than it did Cameron. Although I might actually give Cameron the slight edge over Eva Marie. She's not quite Eva Marie bad, I don't think, but Asuka gets the win. Jason Jordan and Chad Gable did a promo challenging the Ascension to a match next week, calling them the best tag team in NXT history. I don't know if that's more of an indictment on the Ascension or just the way they book these guys on the main roster. Actually, you know, to be fair, in this case, I think it's more the Ascension. Because even back when they were on NXT, I was not impressed. At one point in the promo, Gable started to refer to himself and JJ as the world's greatest tag team, but Jordan quickly cut him off. I thought that was funny. Bull Dempsey pinned Angelo Dawkins with the whoopee cushion off the top rope. Good. Good. That's for that stupid stirring motion that Dawkins keeps doing with his hands. It's fucking annoying. His partner, Sawyer Fulton, was so disgusted by Dawkins losing this match that Fulton walked out when the match was over. I guess that means I now have to find a new tag team not to care about. Bayley revealed that Zack Ryder and Mojo Rawley would be her tag team partners next week against Alexa Bliss and Blake and Murphy. You know, I like Alexa, and I assume that at some point we are going to get a championship match between Bayley and Alexa, but you know, Alexa still, you know, she has a ways to go, and this is a show that had Cameron, a show that had Eva Marie, on the same show, mind you, in the same 50-minute time span, or however long the show is, 55 minutes, we got Cameron and Eva Marie. What we did to deserve that, I'll never know. But I'm looking up and down here, this roster, and it's like, oh boy, this women's division here is dying a slow death now that Sasha Banks is gone, now that most of those horsewomen are gone. Speaking of the women's division dying a death, Eva Marie was out next. Yes, she made it back. Another reason to hate the French. Her opponent was Marley, who they did not really talk about. They didn't really mention her at all. She is gorgeous, I can tell you that. I looked her up. Her name is Gianna Daddio. That's gotta suck. being named after some shitty sitcom on NBC. Which pains me to say that, because Michael Chiklis was on that show, and Michael Chiklis is fucking great. I see now he's on that Gotham show. This girl used to work at Hooters, which I can totally believe. It was an Eva Marie match. I don't really know what else to say about it. It wasn't any worse than usual. I had some people asking me online before I even had a chance to watch the show. They were asking me if I wanted to take back my original buy or sell when I bought on Eva Marie. That was the very first one I ever did. I read that and I thought to myself, oh God, I could only imagine what must have happened in this match. But then I watched the match and it was exactly what I would have expected. You know, the woman still moves in slow motion with everything that she does, you know, like she's underwater. She hit a few moves, including an STO, which she won with, so that may be her new finish. She may have given up on the Kendrick. But she also missed a couple of moves. She pretty much checked off every box on the Eva Marie checklist that you would expect. And still, they're talking about her going after the championship, which scares me. Backstage, Emma and Dana Brooke talked about Asuka. Looks like they're moving ahead with Emma and Asuka coming up next. Possibly at the next TakeOver show, if they can wait that long. I mean, I don't know. That's still about a month away. I could see them doing that match on TV before. Maybe at London at the TakeOver special, it ends up being a handicap match. Maybe it's Dana Brooke and Emma getting their ass kicked by Asuka. By the way, they announced the official theme song for the next TakeOver special is a Motorhead song. I forget which one it is. So if you had any doubt at all about who was in charge and who was running this show, wonder no more. I expect that when the day comes that Triple H takes over from Vince McMahon, the Raw open will be changed to a Motorhead song, and everybody on the show will be required to change their entrance music to Motorhead. And free water bottles will be handed out to the fans as they enter the arena. That's how you'll know it's a Triple H show. This Wednesday, it's going to be Dash and Dawson against the Vaudevillains for the tag team titles, so that's official. Main event was Finn Balor and Apollo Crews for the NXT Championship. I loved what they did for the intros to this match. NXT is great at making their big main event matches, their big championship matches, mostly on the TakeOver specials. This was unique in that we really have never seen this on the main weekly show. But they are so good at making their championship matches feel like a big deal, at making their title matches feel special, like a real, true main event, whether it's just showing them backstage, walking through the hallway, or pacing in the hallway with that brooding music, and then they walk out, which is something WWE used to do with their pay-per-view main events, and when they would have a Hell in a Cell match, and that kind of stuff, and they don't do it anymore. NXT does that almost on every TakeOver special now. What they did here, they had both guys make their entrance, and they did show them backstage before the match, pacing and getting ready. But they both come out, and this was unique in that they have them standing face-to-face in the middle of the ring. They dim the lights. They put a spotlight on them in the middle of the ring while the ring announcer does the intros. I thought that was very cool. So the match starts. Right out of the gate, these guys are just going move for move, tit for tat, back and forth, very evenly matched. I have to say, you know, Apollo Crews, the more I watch him, he is up there with Seth Rollins, I think, as probably the two most athletic guys they have under contract. I mean, this guy is pretty incredible at that size for what he's able to do. It's something you wouldn't expect. He's a special guy. Finn Balor is also very good. So Balor gets the knees up. I'm fast-forwarding a little bit here because, like I said, most of the match, very back and forth, very evenly matched. Balor got the knees up on the standing moonsault attempt when Apollo Crews went for his big move. Running drop kick in the corner by Balor, followed by the coup de grace attempt, but Crews rolled out of the way. Wicked kick to the face by Apollo Crews. Finn Balor immediately counters with a Pele kick, and now both guys are down. They are out. This is awesome chance. That was the cue for Baron. I wrote here, Baron Killjoy Corbin is what I've nicknamed him now. That was his cue to run in for the dreaded DQ. He attacked both guys before Samoa Joe ran down to make the save, or so we thought. Once Finn Balor got back to his feet, Joe absolutely took his head off, beat the crap out of him, put him on the top rope for the muscle buster, but first he looked him in the eye and said, "I did this to you," before then nailing the move. And then Joe picked up the NXT title and draped it over Finn's dead body before walking out. So Samoa Joe has gone over to the dark side, and it looks like we'll be getting that Joe vs. Balor match after all at the next TakeOver special in London. I just thought the presentation of the match itself before the match was excellent. The match itself was excellent, DQ finish aside. I thought the turn by Joe in the end was excellent, great storytelling, and now it builds to the next big main event. NXT does a lot of little things right, and when they do it right, it's awesome. And everything just came together perfectly here in this match. And Apollo Crews looked like a total star. Didn't lose anything by not winning the championship here. Finn Balor and Samoa Joe also should have a pretty damn good match in London. I'm looking forward to that a lot. So big thumbs up for NXT this week. I did not have a chance second week in a row, I know, to see Ring of Honor. And then the tournament stuff that we did at the beginning kind of threw me off here. I could be wrong here. Somebody will let me know. But I think the Jay Lethal Roderick Strong TV title match is next week. I don't think I missed it. I hope not. So that's something I definitely want to see. And if so, we'll talk about that next week. But let's just get into the mailbag here. If you have questions, you can always email them to me, thesolemonster@gmail.com. Please include your name and where you are from when you write in. We'll kick off here with, let's start with Frank from New Jersey. What are your thoughts on Nikki Bella being ranked number one in this year's Pro Wrestling Illustrated Female 50 list? You know, I saw so much anger online about this. And I had people emailing me thinking I'm going to like rant about it and stuff. Oh, please talk about this on the Sound Off. I'm just amazed that anybody still pays attention to those PWI rankings. I mean, I guess it means something to the wrestlers. I know Nikki Bella responded. She posted like this long series of tweets thanking the fans. I mean, you would think this woman won an Academy Award here with what she was posting. I'm going to guess, and I don't know if this applies to Nikki Bella or not, but because a lot of them grew up, a lot of these wrestlers grew up on those old magazines and PWI back in the day, back when they actually meant something, that's why today it means something to them, and I get that. But what I don't understand is, why are the fans getting so worked up about this? It's a kayfabe list. Nikki Bella in kayfabe was the Divas champion for most of the year. So, of course, they're going to rank her number one. She's been number one in that Divas division on TV for most of the year. It's no different than if WWE.com did a similar kind of list, and people still get pissed off over those lists whenever they do one. It's just, it's comical to me. We just went through this with Pro Wrestling Illustrated a few months ago when they announced they weren't going to recognize the TNA title anymore as a world championship. Who cares? Who made them the official body of pro wrestling? If you want to consider the TNA title to be a legitimate world title, then fine. If you don't, then don't. It's all very silly to me. People still getting worked up about Pro Wrestling Illustrated in 2015. I mean, holy shit. Billy from Des Moines, Iowa. I was watching SummerSlam 1999 to check out the Greenwich Street fight that we reviewed here on the Sound Off last week between Test and Shane McMahon, and I forgot that the main event was the triple threat match between Stone Cold Steve Austin, Mankind, and Triple H. It reminded me of the Triple H Thy Kingdom Come DVD, in which they reference but kind of gloss over the fact that Austin did not want to drop the belt to Triple H at the pay-per-view, but instead would drop it to Mankind, who would then drop it to Triple H on Raw the next night. Do you have any idea what that was about? I've never heard of any real-life heat between those two, and I can't really see a reason why Austin would not want to put Triple H over. Any ideas? I don't remember how they referenced that on that Triple H DVD, and I'm pretty sure I saw that. I don't even think they really brought it up. It doesn't really make sense when you think about it, because under triple threat rules, if Austin did not want to lose directly to Triple H, they could have just had Triple H pin Mankind. They could have had Triple H do what he did after the match, which is take out Austin's leg, and it could have been Triple H and Mankind, and Triple H can win. Right? And Triple H pinned Stone Cold on pay-per-view 2 months later anyway at that No Mercy show. So I don't think that there's really much to that story. I think it had more to do personally with the fact that they had booked the governor of the state, okay, Jesse Ventura, to be the guest referee, and they didn't want, or maybe he himself didn't want to count the fall for the heel, you know, make him look bad. You know, they needed a babyface to win so that Jesse could raise his hand and they can get the feel-good moment. And Triple H ended up beating the shit out of Austin's leg with a chair and left him laying anyway after the match. I think if Austin didn't want to put the guy over at all, he would have given Triple H a stunner, and that would have been the end of it. So that's the real reason why I think things went down the way they did. I don't think it was so much any heat that the two of them had, or Austin just not wanting to put the guy over. Sam in Townsville, Australia. Do you think the Austin heel turn in 2001 could have worked, or at least not affected business as badly as it did, if instead of having Austin join up with Triple H, you had Triple H go babyface and feud with Steve Austin? Absolutely not. Absolutely not. Triple H was a big star, but he wasn't that big. You are overestimating is the right word, but you are definitely overplaying how big of a star Triple H was at that time compared to, like, Rock or Austin. Turning Triple H babyface at that point would not have made any difference at all. He came back as a babyface the year after that, and it's not like the guy set the world on fire. In fact, by the middle of the year, he was back to being a heel again. Now, Sam's other question, which team did you prefer as a comedy act, Santino Marella and Beth Phoenix as Glamorella, or Santino and Vladimir Kozlov? I think the easy answer for me is Santino and Kozlov. It's not even close. Tea Time with Santino is still one of the best segments in Raw history. Sean from Los Angeles. I was watching the For All Mankind documentary that WWE released a couple of years ago, and there's a part I don't quite understand. Mick Foley mentioned during his rivalry with Vader in WCW that he had a Lloyd's of London insurance policy that he could not cash in on. What is a Lloyd's of London policy, and has there been any other moments in wrestling where this policy has come into play? Many. Many moments. I don't know if they still do, but lots of wrestlers used to take out insurance policies through Lloyd's of London, which sounds crazy, I mean, when you think about how many wrestlers get injured. But Lloyd's, you know, I'm guessing they probably figured it's a fake sport, right? Quote-unquote fake. Let's not piss anybody off here. And maybe they just felt, yeah, these guys don't really get hurt, it's just they're acting. There were actually quite a few people. I know Kurt Hennig is one, Rick Rude was another, who collected a lot of money, like we're talking potentially all told, like millions, off their policies after they retired. I'm pretty sure that was a big reason why Kurt Hennig left WWF to go to WCW. He was pissed off that Vince McMahon or someone in WWE had allegedly leaked to Lloyd's, this was back in 96, that Hennig was going to be coming back to wrestle again. And he had not wrestled in a long, long time. Probably since 93, and somebody leaked it, and they did so without Hennig's knowledge, and he lost his insurance payouts as a result, and that's why I think ultimately he went to WCW, almost more as like a fuck you to Vince than anything else. Bret Hart was another one. He had a policy, and he had to sue. I remember that. He had to sue Lloyd's of London because I think they wouldn't pay him, and maybe they felt he was exaggerating his injuries, which is nonsense. Obviously, Bret was very legitimately hurt. But I remember when they were doing the Vince McMahon match at WrestleMania 26, there was a big issue there because I guess Lloyd's was putting up a big fuss. They were still paying Bret, and they were putting up a big fuss that this guy was going to do a match. You know, oh, you're so hurt. Now you're going to wrestle this match. And so there was a big problem there. But I guess WWE worked something out with Lloyd's to allow Bret to do the match. Looking back at that match, it'd have been better off if Lloyd's had gotten their way and they never did that fucking thing. Drew from Orlando, Florida. I was wondering if you had any insight into the WCW Halloween Havoc show from 1999. In particular, the scheduled world title match between Sting and Hulk Hogan. Why did Hogan just lay down for Sting? I have read that the match was booked this way, but that just doesn't make any sense to me. It seems like such bad business the way it played out. That is WCW for you. So much has been made of the 2000 Bash at the Beach incident less than a year later, where Hogan laid down for Jeff Jarrett, but given the fact that the Halloween Havoc match featured arguably the two biggest names in the industry, well, let me stop you there. I got news for you. In 99, they were not the two biggest names in the industry. I mean, maybe you could argue Hogan still was, but not Sting. It's not even close. And anyway, so let's just get to his question. What do you know about this? Well, it was one of two things, and to this day, I still am not clear on which it is. Okay, so I don't have a good solid answer for you. I know that Havoc in 99 was the first WCW pay-per-view since Vince Russo joined the company. Okay. What a shock, I know. First pay-per-view in, and already there's this giant swerve here on this show. maybe it was Hogan being a dick because he didn't agree with the creative that was given to him and he did it on his own, right? It's possible, but I think that's very unlikely. I don't know for sure, but I tend to believe it was a storyline. And the idea was that Hogan was going to take some time off after this and then come back, right? I think that had always been the plan anyway. Whatever was going to happen, Hogan was going to go away for at least a few weeks and then make a comeback. But Hogan did have complete creative control over his match finishes. So whatever it wasn't done without Hogan's approval. Whether Hogan went into business for himself or there was an agreed-upon finish, Hogan knew exactly what was going to happen when he walked out there. Put it that way. Just like what happened at Bash at the Beach a year later, except after Hogan laid down for Jarrett, which was the plan, Russo came out and called him a big bald son of a bitch, which was very much not planned, and Hogan ended up winning a bunch of money for it in court. The Havoc thing, I'm pretty sure, was all storyline, what happened here between Hogan and Sting. Sting won the title, then dropped the title to Goldberg at the end of the show, who had already wrestled the match earlier. So Sting doing his best John Cena open challenge impersonation, years before John Cena even did it. It's like magic. And then I think Goldberg actually ended up being stripped of the belt the next night. He lost the belt the next night on Nitro. The whole thing was just a giant clusterfuck. Is it any wonder why this company is dead? I mean, and to think, this fucker actually came out with a book called How WCW Killed Vince Russo. That was the subtitle of this guy's book. Now he's writing emails to Vince McMahon offering to save Vince McMahon's company. Vince probably renamed his spam folder Russo and has all the emails automatically dumped into the folder whenever they come in. If he hasn't, he should. Salvi from Cincinnati. Regarding the multiple replays during Raw, I've noticed the logo of the sponsor, or what Raw is presented by, is always shown. Do you think this has something to do with the tons of replays that we get every single week? It's very possible. It is very, very possible. I would hate to think the only reason they're showing all those replays is just because of the sponsor logos, but you make a good point. Maybe that has something to do with it. It doesn't change the fact that there's just too many replays. I mean, they are out of control. And if that's the reason they do them, then they've got to come up with a more clever way. You know, do what WCW used to do. Put the fucking sponsor logo in the middle of the mat. They used to advertise Slim Jim on the canvas, on the turnbuckles, on the posts. There's any number of things that they could do. But the replays are just out of control. I don't care what their reason is for it. And I don't necessarily buy that that is the reason. But it could be. And if it is, they got to find another way. Because it's just too much. Matt from Houston. As a fan growing up, one of my favorite TV shows was Saturday Night's Main Event on NBC. However, in 1991, NBC stopped showing it until 2006. What was the reason NBC dropped Saturday Night's Main Event? Low ratings. Simple as that. Those shows used to do pretty monster numbers, and they would... You know, they started declining as the 80s went on, and by 1990, 1991, I mean, they were hitting, you know, all-time lows. And so they dropped them. And they had two shows on Fox in 92, and I guess those didn't do well either, because those are the only two Fox ever did, and then we didn't see the show again until 06. Mike from Victorville, California. Steve Austin was hugely over, rolling into SummerSlam, I should say, 1997. However, do you think WWE was able to get him more over post-neck injury because of how much they replayed the incident with Owen Hart and talked about how much of a badass he was? Did WWE's exploitation of Austin's injury contribute in any way to his popularity? I think it added to his legend. It added to his story as this guy that had to overcome adversity to you know, get to the top and to win the championship. 8 years, I busted my ass. I mean... Yeah, I think it added to his story, but I think aside from that, I don't think it had any real impact one way or another on how much the guy got over in late 97, early 98. I think if you take away the neck injury, he's not any more over, he's not any less over. He's exactly as over as he was. And he ends up being, you know what, he ends up being maybe even more successful, because here's the thing, what the injury really did was it shaved years off the guy's career. And it forced him to change his in-ring style, so he couldn't do a lot of that old flashy stuff. I say flashy, it's not like he was jumping off the top rope. But Austin was a much better, like, technical wrestler. If you look at him in 96, in the early part of 97. His style changed very noticeably. He was more of a brawler in 98-99. So the injury was just an absolute negative because Austin had to call it quits in 03, even if he had pre-existing neck issues. Because he said that before. It wasn't just Owen dropping him on his head. He had spinal stenosis. He probably would have had to retire early anyway. I don't buy for a second, though, that without the Owen injury, he has to retire in 03. He can go at least a few more years. We can get a few more matches out of him, big-time matches against who knows who. I mean, maybe, I guess Brock was gone by that point. Maybe Brock, you know, in 03, or Cena. I mean, who knows? Orton, you know, he could still be coming back and doing matches today, like some of the guys do. Rock comes back. He does a match once every 2 years. You know, Batista, we saw him come back. Jericho comes back here and there for house shows. I think Austin would be very similar. I think Austin would be the same kind of guy who at least would do a big pay-per-view match or a big WrestleMania match here and there were it not for getting dropped on his head by Owen Hart in 97. So I look at it as nothing more than just a giant negative. And if it enhanced his story at all, it did just a little bit, but it didn't affect how over he was going to be. The guy was going to be over no matter what. You know, he couldn't wrestle those first few months after he got hurt, so what they had to do, it forced them to come up with other creative things for him to do because he couldn't wrestle. So he was on TV. It wasn't like he was off TV for 3 or 4 months. He was there every single week, terrorizing people, going after Owen Hart, and, you know, that was during the period where he stunned Vince McMahon for the first time in Madison Square Garden. Would they have had him do that if he wasn't hurt? Maybe not. Maybe that first Vince McMahon stunner never happens. I still think at some point it does. But I guess you could argue, well, the injury led to him not being allowed to wrestle, and that was part of the whole promo. Vince said, listen, we're just looking out for you, and then boom, he dropped him with the stunner, and Vince flopped around like a fish. I still think that would have ended up happening at some point anyway. Nick from Germany, buy or sell on who had the better go-to-sleep, Hideo Itami or CM Punk? This is an easy one for me. I mean, Kenta, you know, Hideo Itami, without question. He was the originator of the move. And not only was he the originator of the move, and Punk blatantly took the move from him, which is fine. But if you go back, there's one in particular, and I don't remember where or when it was from. Kenta gave a guy a GTS. He practically caved the guy's face in. He kneed him so hard in the face. Oh my God, some of those GTSs were just so brutal. I'm sorry, I mean, I can't even compare CM Punk's to Kenta's. I mean, Kenta, easy buy on Kenta and sell on Punk when it comes to that. Zach from Marietta, Georgia, buy or sell the Attitude Era or the Ruthless Aggression Era? You know, it'd be easy for me to say Ruthless Aggression just because the Attitude Era is so damn played out already. I think people are sick and tired of hearing about it. And in some ways, you can argue it's overrated, the Attitude Era. But I'm going to buy on Attitude. I'm going to sell on Ruthless Aggression. The big thing that the Ruthless Aggression Era had over the Attitude Era was the wrestling, right? In the ring, far superior. Lots of great matches. Lots of great wrestlers. You had the SmackDown 6. SmackDown became the A-show over Raw for a while. Michael Cole and Taz became a strong announced team. I like Michael Cole and Taz. I liked by the end there the chemistry that they had together. And I thought Michael Cole, as an announcer back then, far better than what they have him doing now. The Billy and Chuck wedding angle happened during that period, you know, in the Ruthless Aggression era on SmackDown. That was a great angle. Brock Lesnar, dancing mariachi. Lots of great things about the Ruthless Aggression era to go back and smile about. And the rise of a lot of the big names that we see today. John Cena came up during that era. Randy Orton, Brock Lesnar, Batista. I was even a fan of JBL's first run with the title. You know, I thought he grew into the top heel role very nicely. Now, on the flip side of that, you had JBL as the WWE champion. Why did you have JBL as the WWE champion? Because by that point, they didn't have as many stars as they had during the Attitude Era. They needed to make a new star, and they just literally, like, overnight. I mean, 1 week he was Bradshaw, the next week he's out there with a cowboy hat and a book in his hand. How to make more money, or whatever the hell, make more money now, doing the new character. There was no slow burn transition into it, nothing. Just he showed up 1 week, and that was it. And by that point, like I said, they didn't have as many stars. The star power of the Attitude Era just cannot be matched. Steve Austin, megastar. The Rock, megastar. Undertaker, big star. Mankind, big star. Triple H by 2000, big star. When everybody is over, it makes the product that much more fun. Now, yes, the quality of the matches maybe wasn't what it is today, or what it was during the Ruthless Aggression era, but when they did those big pay-per-view main events right, they were a lot of fun. And as over as all the top guys were, so were the mid-card guys. All those guys at that middle level, they were over too. The New Age Outlaws, super over. Godfather, super over. Al Snow, super over because of a mannequin head. Actually, the head was probably more over than he was. They had the 24/7 hardcore title rule. That was a lot of fun. DX against The Nation, that was a lot of fun. Austin against McMahon, that was a lot of fun. It became a game of, you know, what crazy stunt can they come up with this week? 1 week Austin would ride a beer truck to the ring. Then he'd ride a Zamboni. Then, which, by the way, the Zamboni thing, still one of the loudest crowd reactions I've ever heard in my life. Then he'd dress up as a doctor and he would attack Vince in the hospital with a bedpan. And what helps is that Mr. McMahon character, in my opinion, is the greatest villain that company has ever produced. Their greatest heel wasn't even a wrestler. The characters on those shows were just so much better than almost anything we have today because people cared about them. You know, I mean, man, if Austin got screwed over by Vince McMahon, and he did a few times, people were fucking furious. I still remember when Vince fired him, they had a Judgment Day pay-per-view. It was an Undertaker and Kane main event. Austin was the referee. And Austin basically just said, fuck you, he stunned them both, right? This was when Vince McMahon was, for whatever reason, he was in a wheelchair, he was up in his... It was like the Pope. He was like in this glass-encased area, and people were throwing shit, and they were throwing debris at him. And he announced that Austin was fired. Because Austin had one job, call that match down the middle, and he didn't do it. So Vince fired him. And I remember reading that the next day, they had people flooding Titan Tower with phone calls. They were so angry, and they thought it was real. I mean, that's real emotion right there, and partial stupidity, too. But that's real emotion. I don't know if you can blame that on social media or if you can blame that on just poor, character development today, but we don't see that anymore. Most weeks, you couldn't wait for next Monday during that era. Raw would end and you'd be upset. Oh, shit, I gotta wait a whole week now. Now, I'm grateful most weeks when it's over, if I haven't already fallen asleep. It was must-see TV back then, even after Russo left. And Russo does deserve credit for a lot of that. I'm going to give him his just due. He was part of that whole machine. But even after he left in 2000, that may have been their best year of all. They didn't have Steve Austin, which is even more impressive. They did it without him. But you had Rock and Triple H, the two young guys leading the charge, taking the company on their back. And look at all the amazing talent that they had backing them up on that roster. Benoit and Eddie came over from WCW. You had the rise of Kurt Angle, Rikishi and Too Cool, Edge and Christian, and the Hardys and the Dudleys doing their thing. I can't bring myself to say that the Ruthless Aggression era is better than the Attitude era. I mean, yes, Mae Young gave birth to a hand, which I still don't understand. And I heard Mark Henry's interview with Chris Jericho on Talk Is Jericho a few months ago. He doesn't get it either. Jericho doesn't get it. Mark Henry doesn't get it. You know, Mark Henry asked Vince after it was all done, hey, Vince, why a hand? And Vince was just like, it's a hand! There may be absolutely no explanation for it whatsoever, but to this day, I just don't get it. You had, you know, lots of two-minute matches on TV during the Attitude. I mean, forget about it. All the wrestling purists today, if you had all those Attitude Era matches that you had then that went like 90 seconds and 2 minutes and 3 minutes, I mean, they'd be, rioting with pitchforks outside Titan Tower now. But the characters and the star power and the fucking fantastic crowds that actually gave a shit about what they were seeing. I mean, you would look out in the crowd, you saw nothing but signs. I mean, it probably sucked to be sitting behind one of them, but you just looked at the crowd and it's like, holy shit. Look at this. This is unbelievable. You can't even see people. You just see signs. And believe me, those signs were not being handed out. Okay, people were creating them and bringing them themselves. It was crowds that actually gave a shit about what they were seeing, and you had Jim Ross and Jerry Lawler on headset. No wonder everything was so over during the Attitude Era. You had Jim Ross on commentary calling all of it. I mean, I like Michael Cole, like I said, during the Ruthless Aggression era, but he was no Jim Ross. And here's another reason why I can't put the Ruthless Aggression era over Attitude. Because if you consider the 2002 to 2004 period of Raw to be part of that Ruthless Aggression era, and I, you know, some people will say it's only like SmackDown and not Raw, but I guess all of it is kind of lumped into that era. If you do that, there's no way it was better than Raw during the Attitude Era. And I thought Eric Bischoff did a good job as the Raw GM. I thought he was good in that role, but it coincided with Triple H's reign of terror as the world champion, which were some of the dark days of Raw. At least you had variety during that period on SmackDown. That's why SmackDown was the A show. The Attitude Era is glorified a lot these days, especially by WWE. I mean, they're the ones doing it. It's not even the fans. It's WWE that keeps shoving the Attitude Era down our throat. It wasn't perfect, but if you missed an episode, you felt like you missed a lot. And it was a lot of fun to be a fan back then, especially with the competition between WWF and WCW. You had a real war going on as opposed to a manufactured one with the brand split. And the original brand split was pretty cool, but, and it got worse as time went on because they forgot how to do a brand split. But it was still a manufactured war. It was still WWE. Everybody knew it. So how do you go from a real war to a fake one? So for all those different reasons, I'm going to buy on Attitude and I'm going to sell on Ruthless Aggression. And the time has come to wrap up the countdown of eight of my favorite WWE matches of all time. Like I said at the beginning of the podcast, I have thoroughly enjoyed doing this. It looks like you guys have too. It's bittersweet for it to come to an end, but we've been doing this now for 8 weeks. Again, these matches are in no particular order. They are eight of my favorite matches in WWE history without necessarily being the top eight. They are eight of my favorites. And just to recap real quick, go through the list. Match number one was the 1992 Royal Rumble. Match number two was Steve Austin against Dude Love from Over the Edge 98. Match number three was Shawn Michaels against The Undertaker from WrestleMania 25. Match number four was Bret Hart against Mr. Perfect from The King of the Ring in 1993. Match number five was The Shield against the Wyatt family at Elimination Chamber 2014. Match number six was the 10-man tag from Raw back in 2000, Triple H, X-Pac, and the Radicals against The Rock, Cactus Jack, Rikishi, and Too Cool. And match number seven was the Love Her or Leave Her Greenwich Street Fight between Test and Shane McMahon from SummerSlam 1999. And so now we come to match number eight. There have been a lot of people that have been trying to guess all week, oh, what's the match going to be? I bet I know what it is. It's going to be a Daniel Bryan match, or it's going to be Shawn Michaels against Kurt Angle at WrestleMania 21, or it's going to be a random, like a tag team match from Raw. A lot of people thought it was going to be Austin and Triple H against Jericho and Benoit. Great match, not on the list. And like I said before, I don't think anybody would really be able to guess correctly what the match is. I wanted to go with a match that is absolutely a favorite of mine, and it has been since I saw it for the first time, and I still remember watching it that day. It's a match that cannot be found on the network. And when I first started this list, I thought it was the only match that you can't find on the network until I realized that they have no Raw episodes up from 2000, so this is actually the second match in the countdown that you can't find on the network. But it is on Daily Motion. You can actually find this match cut up into two parts. The quality, though, is not great. I did find somebody on Daily Motion who posted the full episode of Superstars that this match is from, and has the match on there in better quality. And what I'll do is, I'll link to that Daily Motion video on my Twitter and my Facebook page after I upload this week's show. So I'll be getting that link up for anybody who wants to watch the match in the best possible quality. It's still not HD, but it's better, I think, than what you'll find elsewhere. It's a match that aired on the July 30th, 1994 episode of WWF Superstars. And it was a rare championship match. You did not see WWE title matches on Superstars very often, but you did this week. And it was Bret the Hitman Hart defending the championship against Bob Backlund. So there's a match I bet people weren't expecting. This is a severely underrated match, one that does not get as much attention as the other two matches that these guys had back in 94. Actually, one in 94, one in 95, because those two matches aired on pay-per-view. The Survivor Series match, where Backlund won the title from Brett. Remember, Owen Hart coerced Helen Hart, their mother, into throwing in the towel. Brett was locked in the chicken wing for like 6 minutes straight. And then their I Quit match that had Roddy Piper as the guest referee at WrestleMania 11, the worst WrestleMania of all time. And that last Brett Backlund match at that WrestleMania, it was actually a perfect fit for that shit show. Those two went perfectly together. If that was the only exposure that I had ever seen to Bret Hart against Bob Backlund, I wouldn't want to see those two guys within 50 feet of each other, let alone in a wrestling ring together. And I don't know if it was just because Backlund at that point was wrestling a heel style, it was just very different, because he was Crazy Bob and not just Bob Backlund the wrestler, and so he altered his style. I mean, it was less than a year after this match here that I'm reviewing, how they can go from having such a good match to having such just a total shit fest is just shocking to me. This match here from Superstars in 94 is a hidden gem, and everyone should take the 20 minutes to watch it. It does start out a little slowly. This is not balls-to-the-wall action from start to finish, so don't go into it expecting that. It's just a well-worked technical wrestling match. More than anything, it told a great story. And the payoff with the Backlund turn in the end was just masterful. I would even argue, when you keep in mind that they were trying to tell a story here, the story that they told, it was one of the most well-done heel turns in WWE history. I really think if it's not the best one, it's way up there. Now, to give you a little backstory here, Bob Backlund had been the WWF champion in the late 70s into the early 80s. He was champion for like 5.5 years straight. And when he lost the championship at the end of 1983, it was to the Iron Sheik, who was really just a transitional champion to get the belt off Backlund and put it on their new top babyface, Hulk Hogan. Backlund never submitted. He was locked in the camel clutch. His manager, Arnold Skolin, threw in the towel, and that, I guess, represented a submission, and the Iron Sheik won the belt. Backlund, I think, stuck around for a little while after that, but he didn't do much, and he was gone, you know, shortly thereafter. So Backlund now has been gone from the company for years and years and years. And Bob Backlund at the time, I mean, he was the quintessential, you know, white meat babyface. There was nothing overly exciting about the guy. He was a great, you know, amateur wrestler. He would do a lot of amateur, you know, chain wrestling type stuff. But there really wasn't much more to him than that. You know, he wasn't a particularly great, you know, interview guy. He didn't have a character or a gimmick or anything like that. He was just, you know, the top babyface wrestling champion. That's what he was. So he comes back to WWF, and it's a very, very different company than when he left. He came back in 1992. When he came back in 92, the story was, it's Bob Backlund trying to make a comeback at the age of 43. His best performance, maybe, from the point that he came back until now, in this match here, was in the Royal Rumble match in 1993. They had him come in at number one. He went all the way to the end. I mean, he was probably the second to last guy that was dumped out. And by the end of that Rumble match, you know, you could say as like boring and dull as he was, he had people cheering for him. They were pissed when Backlund got eliminated from the Rumble match. So that was a huge performance for him. Aside from that performance in the 93 Rumble, he did nothing. He was back in the company for 2 years before even getting this match with Bret Hart. In that time, aside from the Rumble, name me one thing that he did. He did nothing. He was just there, you know, floundering around, putting over different people. He was like a mid-card guy. He was relegated to being a mid-card guy. This was the champion for almost 6 years straight, and he was just a mid-card guy in the WWF in 1992. Now he's getting his championship match, the first championship match that he's getting since he lost the belt to the Sheik in 83. And this was also Bret Hart at his absolute best. This is my favorite time period for Bret Hart, who is my favorite. You think about the run of great matches that Bret Hart was having here in 94. He had that classic match with Owen Hart at WrestleMania 10. He had the an excellent title defense against the 1-2-3 Kid on Raw this same month. It was only a few weeks before this match. He beat the 1-2-3 Kid. I think it's one of Brett's favorite matches, too. Then he has this match with Backlund on Superstars, which is very, very good. Then he has the cage match with Owen Hart at SummerSlam a few weeks after that, which is still my favorite steel cage match they've ever done. I mean, Brett was just on fire during this period. Business may not have been on fire, but wrestling, you know, pretty much was in the shitter overall in 94, except maybe in Japan. I don't know what was going on over there at the time, but certainly in this country, wrestling was just shit in the bed in 1994 in terms of popularity and business. But here's the thing, though. Without Brett, WWF would have been in real rough shape. As rough a shape as they may have been in, without Brett, it would have been far worse. Inside the ring, you couldn't touch the guy. I mean, he was just at the top of the list. So, in the weeks leading up to this match, they were airing training vignettes on TV on all the syndicated shows, showing Bob Backlund just really taking this seriously and training and getting ready to, you know, to take on Bret Hart. And they have the match. Backlund comes out, no theme music. Talk about old school. No theme song. He comes to the ring, gets a ring intro. Bret comes out. Right out of the gate, Backlund surprises him. He goes for the quick win. Kind of catches Brett by surprise. On commentary, they have Jerry Lawler telling the story, trying to convey the story that Bret Hart, he may have taken Bob Backlund lightly. You know, he's an old man, and, you know, Brett's not taking this seriously. Now, Lawler crapped all over Brett during the match anyway, because the two of them were still feuding. I mean, Lawler and Brett feuded for, like, over 2 years. They have a match, goes back and forth. Backlund, very impressive at one point, doing some bridge-ups out of a pin attempt by Bret Hart, bridging up with his head. Here's the thing about Bob Backlund that I think a lot of people don't get. Bob Backlund was deceptively strong. You would never guess it just by looking at the guy, but Backlund was, I mean, scary strong, and that was on display only a little bit here. He was very, very strong. Kind of like the way Cesaro is also, I think, deceptively strong. He's in great shape, you know he's strong, but you don't know how strong Cesaro really is. When Mark Henry puts you over as being the strongest guy he knows, that's pretty fucking strong. Backlund is kind of like Cesaro in that way. Actually, he's probably like Cesaro in a lot of ways, in that you look at the guy, and yeah, maybe he doesn't look like much, and you may think, well, he's boring, or he's kind of dull, but these guys are very, very impressive, and they can go. They have this match, it's almost 20 minutes long, 15, 20 minutes. Back and forth. Backlund has given Brett a run for his money. I mean, really, I think most people probably going into, like, most casual fans, and at the time, I was pretty young, so even I really wasn't that familiar with Bob Backlund, you know, back in his heyday, and I probably looked at the guy and thought to myself, all right, whatever, there's nothing much here. But it was a very evenly matched, back and forth battle between these two guys. Anything but a throwaway match. If you thought that going in, you realize pretty quickly this was not a throwaway match. Fast forward toward the end, Backlund gets a small package that leads to a very, very close near fall. Close enough that Backlund thinks he won. He jumps up, he's celebrating like he won the championship, then he quickly realizes he didn't. He picks up Bret Hart. Bret, though, catches him with an inside cradle, and he gets the pin. It was perfect because he didn't beat Backlund decisively with the sharpshooter in the middle. He had to surprise him with a roll-up just to get the win. And it plays into what happened after the match, which just put this whole thing over the top. So the match itself was actually very good, surprisingly good. But what pushes it into classic territory for me, and probably why I still really remember it, you know, when I watched it as a kid, is what happened afterward. Backlund can't believe it. I mean, he just can't believe that he got beat. And he's very upset. You can tell he's very upset. But he goes over to Brett after he gets his bearings, and he puts his hand out. He extends his hand, just like the good sport that he is, and Brett shakes his hand, and they embrace, and Backlund holds up Brett's arm, and he points to him like, great. Great show of sportsmanship here. So Backlund, he stays in the ring. He doesn't leave the ring. Brett's going from corner to corner, posing with the belt. And Brett decides, I'm going to extend my hand so Bob Backlund can shake my hand again. And I have to tell you, even when I watched this as a kid, and Jerry Lawler read my mind because he ended up saying the same exact thing like 10 seconds later on commentary. Jerry Lawler's like, you know, what are you doing now? You're trying to rub it in his face? You know, you're trying to like embarrass the guy? Like, you already got one handshake. You know, the guy is obviously upset. Why are you going to shake his hand again? Brett's, no, shake my hand. And the camera gets up close in Bob's face. And you can almost see the transformation taking place. Like, he's morphing in that one instance from Bob Backlund to crazy Mr. Backlund. He hauled off and slapped Bret Hart so hard in the face. This was one of those slaps that's like, holy shit. He slapped the taste out of this guy's mouth. And it came out of nowhere. Nobody was expecting it. The idea of Bob Backlund turning heel was just so unfathomable to a lot of people. I mean, me, it's like, I didn't have the perspective as young as I was of Bob, you know, what he was back in the day. It was still surprising to me to see him do it, but I would imagine for somebody who was actually a little older and familiar with Bob's work, they probably were shocked by the whole thing. So it was a shocking thing for this guy to turn heel. And so he slaps Bret Hart in the face, and then he puts him in the crossface chicken wing, which I don't recall seeing Backlund use since he came back to the company in 92, maybe ever. I mean, again, people who maybe were more familiar with his original run could speak to this, whether he used to use that move 20 years before or 15 years before, but I had never seen him use it before. So he puts Bret Hart in the chicken wing, which just looks like a painful fucking hold. And he has this thing hooked in, and the camera is just showing Bob Backlund's face. He is just psychotic. He's got this psychotic look. You can see the little bones in his throat. He is so just out of his mind. He gets Bret Hart down. He wraps his legs around him, so he's got this grapevine on him. And he won't let go. And the referees have to come out, and multiple referees come out. They're trying to pull Backlund off Bret. Jerry Lawler says, this guy's got the strength of 10 men. They'll never be able to pull him off. And finally, Backlund gets off. He's looking down at his hands. Okay, like Ultimate Warrior used to talk to his hands. Bob Backlund looks down at his hands like he can't believe what just happened. Like he snapped back out of it. And he's looking at his hand. Can't believe what just happened. And then he just leaves. This was so well done. This whole thing was so well done. And to go back to the chicken wing for a second, the chicken wing is my all-time favorite submission hold. And it probably stems from this whole angle here. I used to put that hold on my brother all the time as a kid. I mean, it was so easy. You sneak up behind the person. It's very easy. You could put that move on from almost anywhere. And I'd sneak up behind him, and I'd put him in the chicken wing, and he would scream. Oh, it was great. It was so great. And now you have Asuka using the crossface chicken wing on NXT, which is just another reason I love that woman so much. She's just great. So we have Backlund now. This was the transformation. This was the transformation from white meat babyface to crazy psychotic heel. You can only refer to him as Mr. Backlund. If you refer to him as Bob, okay, he'd put you in the chicken wing. He would walk around claiming he was still the uncrowned WWF champion. He never submitted to the Iron Sheik in 1983, and therefore he never lost the title. He started putting the chicken wing on different people each week. One week he put it on a WWF magazine editor. That looked great. This guy was half Backlund's size, and Backlund was just, it was brutal. I mean, he had him in the chicken wing, but he was like flinging this guy around like he weighed 50 pounds, and maybe the guy did. Another week he would put it on Arnold Skoland, who is his old manager, the guy that threw the towel in and cost him the championship against the Iron Sheik. He put him in the chicken wing. Crazy Bob Backlund was legitimately scary those first few months. He became, you know, a caricature after a while, but in the beginning, I don't care what anybody says, this guy was fucking scary. He was unnerving just to watch him. And like I said, then it kind of became a joke after a while. Now, the rumor at the time, and I don't know that it's ever been verified, but the rumor was that the original idea that WWF had was to bring back Papa Shango. Now, Papa Shango had left the company the year before. They were going to bring him back with the idea that Bob Backlund was under his voodoo spell. And that's why Backlund snapped and became all crazy and nutsy cuckoo. The idea got dropped. Now, they did bring Shango back to the company a few months later. In fact, a few months after this match, they brought him back with that as Kama. Okay, he was like a UFC Street Fighter type character. So they didn't bring him back with the Papa Shango character. So the timeline does fit if they had this idea and then they decided against it and they said, well, listen, we're not going to bring you back as Papa Shango. Let's wait a few months. We'll bring you back in some other role. So it does fit That may well have been what happened. I just don't know for sure. Backlund has a new book out. Maybe he talks about it in there. I haven't had a chance to read it yet. But from start to finish, this was a piece of storytelling as good as any that you'll see from WWE, and much better than a lot of the kind of storytelling you would see these days, which I always laugh. I always laugh at that because now more than ever, WWE loves to say, you know, we're not wrestling. We're entertainment. We're storytellers. We tell stories. And I say to myself, if that's true, then how is it that a lot of these stories from 20, 25 years ago, 15 years ago were so much better? You know? If you're storytellers now, you would think you got 3 hours of television, you got all these great, you know, athletes and characters, and they can't seem to tell stories as good as they used to back in the day. This was so simple, and it was so unexpected, and I think it just does not, it's criminal that this match does not get the kind of attention that it deserves, and that probably the other two matches they had get more attention, and those matches sucked by comparison, especially that WrestleMania match. It was just, ugh, it was so awful, so awful. So I'm going to put the link up to the Daily Motion video. It's got the complete Superstars episode from July 30th, 1994. You guys can watch it. It's like the second match, I think, on the show. It's not at the end. It's right in the middle. And I would definitely urge you to take 20 minutes out of your day, check it out from start to finish, including that post-match angle, which really put the whole thing over the top. And it is one of my favorite WWE matches of all time. And that's the countdown. That's 8 of my favorite matches in WWE history. Next week, we are going to talk about Eddie Guerrero. It is going to be the 10-year anniversary of his death. I don't know what we're going to do exactly, but I will definitely do something Eddie-themed or focused for next week, even if it's just talking about the guy and his career for a few minutes, because he deserves that. And keep sending in your questions for the mailbag and buy or sell suggestions. TheSolomonster@gmail.com. Follow me on Twitter, @Solomonster. I'll put the Daily Motion link up there, as well as on Facebook, facebook.com/TheSolomonster. And we have a Facebook group that you can apply to as well for membership if you'd like. Lots of different ways to keep in touch with the show and be part of it. And if you want to support the show, you can make a PayPal donation on TheSolomonster.com. You can use our Audible link. You can buy a shirt. There's a new one going up very, very soon. In fact, possibly by the time many of you listen to this. And just keep on spreading the word. And again, this is 8 years that I've been doing this show. It's been a lot of fun. I've been doing this a lot longer than I ever thought I would. That was not the plan, I could tell you, when I first started recording this show. But it's turned into something so much more, and I'm grateful for it. And I've been introduced to a lot of great people because of this show as well. And I've had the chance to meet a lot of great people when I go to WrestleMania and these different shows. And I'll be doing that again next year. And it's just a fucking blast, and a lot of it is because of this podcast. So here's to 8 more years. Thank you all for the support. We will see you right back here again next weekend for episode 409. So until then, be well, stay safe, and we will see you right back here again for more Sound Off next weekend. Until then, take care, guys.
The good, the bad, and the ugly. The Solomonster sounds off.
Watch these promos on NXT. Watch Raw. Watch a Randy Orton promo or a Sheamus promo. They never, ever look at the camera. It's because that's what they teach them now. You are not allowed to look into the camera. I think it's just completely idiotic. Why are their eyes not on me? That's how interviews always were. They're talking to me. They're speaking to us. They're supposed to be speaking to the fans. Maybe that's part of the reason why these people can't make a connection with the audience. Because they don't fucking look at us.
Solomonster sounds off.
Since 2007, the Solomonster sounds off. Available at thesolomonster.com, Stitcher Radio, TuneIn Radio, iTunes, and more.
Solomonster sound off.